Or you can visit his website at www.michaelparenti.org. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
He was just 15, he was a new trainee.
Fight for me, jingle, don't you speak for me, jingle, don't you fight for me, jingle, don't you speak for me.
To the man who owns the land, we're all the same, but when his grip begins to slip, then he'll be calling out your name.
The U.S. nuclear weapons program has created several generations of unwitting and unacknowledged casualties. Earlier this month, Mike McCormick of KCMU in Seattle spoke with Jay Truman, director of Downwinders Org, a group trying to get reparations for those injured by atomic radiation.
At the beginning of this year, the media carried stories of a leaked Department of Energy report which stated what had long been argued by many, that up to 600,000 workers employed in the U.S. nuclear weapons program had received excessive doses of radiation and may be suffering from multiple types of cancers. Since then, the DOE and White House have proposed a compensation package for the injured workers and are in the process of placing that package on a congressional fast track. But there are many who are highly critical of the DOE's offer of compensation. Jay Truman, director of downwinders.org for over 20 years, and himself a downwinder, has been at the forefront of the fight to bring the downwinders case to the court of public opinion. I spoke with him by phone this week about the DOE proposal and about his organization.
Yeah, we were formed in the 70s among people who lived in the areas immediately downwind of the Nevada test site, and who had been there when they had conducted the above-ground nuclear tests. And we moved from that into basically victims' work in general, from uranium mining to test site workers to facility workers, and went from a regional to basically international in scope.
How did you get interested in this issue?
One of the first things I can remember in life was sitting on my father's knee out with our cattle watching an atomic bomb go off, seeing the mushroom rise out of the desert and that type of thing. And it's always been a part of life, and so has the health effects in family and friends and so on.
So you grew up seeing the atomic blasts down in Utah?
Yes. Wow. Yes, we lived almost on the Utah-Nevada border. in southwest Utah, just north of St. George. And we had ranching and farming interests over the line in Nevada as well.
Tell me a little bit more about that. What was that like? How many explosions or tests did you see while you were...
I think checking from my my diary that I kept and also the journal my mother did, around 30, give or take a couple, of actually witnessing, you know, light up the sky and that kind of thing.
And what was your reaction as a child to that?
They upset me a great deal. They scared me. And especially when, on one hand, we were always told there was no danger and there wouldn't be any problem, and yet you could turn on the radio or even the TV when we got it, and hear Linus Pauling and others debating, you know, the fallout debate, and saying that, you know, for every megaton tested, there'd be X number of cases of leukemia among children, and then seeing clusters of childhood leukemia start showing up.
Did you share that same feelings with other children, the fear of what was going on then?
Yes. Whenever anybody was to, it got to the point that where if you were a kid and you had a nosebleed or two out of the clear blue, that was the fear. I remember when I have a sister that's 10 and a half years older than I am, and when she had her first child, he developed anemia. I mean, he went real pale and white. And that was the automatic assumption that it was leukemia. It turned out not to be, but that was the fear that that was there. And then following that, it was cancers in general, and with the same kind of fear, to the point people would not even want to go see the doctor over a health problem because, you know, well, we know what it is anyway. We've had it.
Were there government representatives that would come by and tell people that there was nothing to fear?
We had them in our schools about every 6 weeks. And we had them in town a couple of times a year with their little road shows, you know, that there is no danger, it's safe, it can't cause any problems, and we have to keep it up or the Russians will be here in the morning. And that went on and on and on.
And did you generally feel better after they'd been there, or did you feel like you'd been further snookered?
In the beginning, it was just something that happened, and it was upsetting because they played propaganda games and frightened us a bit. And then later on, it was just like, you know, what are you doing standing here lying to us? And to the point now that they don't do the road shows anymore because they get yelled down for spreading BS.
And how long were you in, did you live in that area?
I lived there until I graduated from high school and my first 2 years of college, and then I moved out.
Now you currently reside in Idaho, is that correct?
Yes, in Idaho, yes.
Seems somewhat ironic to me that I believe with the recent studies they did on the Nevada test site explosions...
At the fallout pass, yes.
A lot of it came raining down onto Idaho.
Yes. I am living in a county that had more fallout than the county where I grew up.
Did you know that when you moved, prior to moving there, or was that...
Oh, yeah, I knew that. See, we had tried way back in the late 70s and early 80s to drive that point home that the fallout had not stopped at a county line barbed wire fence somewhere in Utah. But it had spread nationwide, and therefore there would be victims nationwide. And it was that pressure which forced Utah Senator Hatch to order the to get the Congress to order the National Cancer Institute to do that study you were talking about.
So just a couple months back then to bring us up to the current date, the Department of Energy came forward and the Clinton administration, and admitted that perhaps they did actually injure nuclear workers, people working in the atomic weapons section. And they're offering compensation now to some of those workers.
Some of those workers.
What do you see? Do you see this as a good step forward, or what problems do you see with what they're offering?
I see it as deja vu. Sitting there watching the press conference that DOE Secretary Richardson had here on April 12th, that was my first reaction, is deja vu. it just is so much like what they did and tried to pull on the people downwind of the Nevada test site 10 years ago. It's a little bit frightening.
What happened 10 years ago?
10 years ago, the government approved the RECA Compensation Act, Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which was supposed to provide justice for everybody, which turned out to be the poorest excuse of a compensation bill. It limited the fallout to 9 counties, and anyone outside of those counties were not eligible, and the highest fallout areas of the country were not even remotely close to the counties that were covered. The list of cancers was way lower than it should have been. It didn't include, originally it didn't include test site workers. It didn't include all of the uranium miners. It mainly included white uranium miners. The Native Americans were basically excluded from it because of the provisions that had to be met. They could not meet those requirements. There was no recourse to appeal. There was no medical care, just a lump sum payment of $50,000. And it did more harm and caused more problems and hurt feelings among the population it was supposed to be helping. And it very soon became clear that it was more a public relations compensation act than it was a radiation victims compensation act. And it's the same thing. You know, a corner has been turned. We've reached a new milestone. I mean, some of the same phrases that were being used by the Richardson is the same that they said to us.
So on this specific act that they're coming forward with, I believe they have stated that the estimate is 600,000 workers.
Workers were exposed, and maybe as many as 3,000 of them might receive some compensation.
So that is like less than a percent.
It's 0.5%. Again, we have a Public Relations Compensation Act compensating the Department of Energy and the government for any public relations embarrassment they may have been receiving over the years from their screaming victims, in my opinion. It's another what we always refer to RECA as blood money. Our blood and their money, so we won't tell anybody. And I think this is the same type of thing. And it doesn't cover everybody. It covers workers, but it doesn't cover residents who lived off-site of the same facilities, and who received just as much, if not more, exposure than the workers did. They are not covered.
It seems fairly limited in how much it will cover even those that few thousand people.
Yeah, and if you take and read the fine print, there are enough loopholes that you could sail a fleet of Titanics through them so that very few of those who think they're going to be covered will actually end up being covered. There's time limits and there's, you know, different technical things, and in the end, very little has changed. Other than the White House will be able to get it passed and then say, well, we did the right thing, we have resolved the problem, and it's over and done. It's behind us. And it'll be another 10 or 15 years before the victims who were excluded from this bill have any hope of forcing Congress to look at it again. And sadly, by then, a large number of them will be dead.
It seems in some ways that if we just focus for a minute on just the workers, that if only half of 1% are going to be compensated, that you still have, obviously, a sizable number there who are going to be very irate and very upset.
Yes.
Isn't that a bad strategy just from the DOE standpoint?
You know, except that the White House and the DOE is moving heaven and hell to railroad this thing through as rapidly as possible before the victims realize that only 0.5% of them are going to be compensated. I mean, a good example of the real problem is that we're talking about 600,000 workers, and we're talking about how maybe 3,000 of them may get compensated. The National Cancer Institute fallout report on Nevada testing said that nationwide, the fallout caused up to a quarter of a million cases of thyroid cancer. And yet, compensating the Cold War victims is only going to be 3,000 workers. I think that makes a statement as to its both its sincerity and its real value as a measure of justice.
From the standpoint, you are a downwinder yourself, and you're representing a lot of other downwinders that are not being compensated at all in this bill.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that there's been a rift going now because of this, that's actually been going for a long time, but this is just exacerbating it, between actual nuclear workers and downwinders.
Well, I think that's the government's intention.
So if they take care of just the nuclear workers,
and they can divide the victims and get them fighting amongst themselves to the point that the victims can't unite and force the government to do what is right. That's what they've always done. With the RICO stuff, they originally left out the test site workers. They tried to kick out the atomic veterans. After RICO was passed, the Nevada congressional delegation pulled some fast maneuvers and managed to get some of the test site workers attached. Additional work supposedly got the atomic veterans covered, but yet only 30 of them have received any, out of 250,000 exposed, have received any major. This divide and conquer of what we've always referred to as being the difference between justice and just us has always been the DOE's policy. That way it reduces the number of unified victims.
So I understand right now there is an effort amongst downwinders to try and either get a separate bill introduced or to get an addition to the current compensation bill.
Well, what we would like to see is the entire problem addressed. If we're going to provide justice for this nation's Cold War victims, and then that is precisely what we should do, and that means all of them. From the uranium miners on one end of the process to the test site workers and atomic vets and downwinders who ate the fallout produced in the plants and facilities by the workers in between. Everybody needs to be treated equally. No favoritism to any one side. We felt that way when we opposed RICO 10 years ago, because it didn't include the workers, didn't include the atomic veterans, and so on.
How many people would you estimate are in that group?
Probably the bulk of the American population that was living during the 50s and 60s. To really address the problem, the main thing that needs to be done is to make sure that everybody has proper medical care to start with.
So we're talking tens of millions at the low end.
Yes. And that is something the public needs to face up to one of these days. The National Cancer Institute report said that 160 million Americans received excessive doses to their thyroids from iodine-131 from the Nevada test site alone. Hanford released huge amounts. INEL released emissions. Oak Ridge, Paducah, Portsmouth, Rocky Flats, Savannah River, on and on and on. And you cannot say one group or one select population deserves help for their illnesses and not everybody help. The public needs to know that the Cold War didn't just extract a huge financial cost and $3 trillion worth of national debt. It also extracted a huge human toll. And only by forcing the government to admit the extent of the problem and the number of people who were exposed is that message ever going to get driven home. And if that message isn't driven home, there's never going to be the kind of awareness and concern to prevent there ever being another situation like that from occurring, where the government can kill its own and get away with it.
Where can people get some more information on some of these numbers you're talking about in these reports?
They can check out our website. We're trying to keep it updated as currently current as we can to what all is going on with these compensation bills. There's now three different versions to do with the workers and another version out there to try to fix problems with the original RICO. They can check out our website. That's www.downwinders.org.
Let's talk about these compensation bills that you all are working on. I understand that the government's, the Department of Energy's, has put forward its bill.
The White House's version. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they are working very quickly to get that through the House. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, get it through Congress, period. They want to attach it as a rider to the defense authorization bill.
I mean, we're talking something that potentially could happen in the next...
or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Behind closed doors, in secret, just as the decisions that victimized everybody occurred.
Do you know offhand the number on that defense bill? Is that something that people
can... It's just the defense authorization bill.
Okay.
No, I don't know
okay.
the number.
But I'm assuming that, obviously, that's something that almost assuredly every year or every 2 years goes through, but still people calling their congressional representatives might have a chance to influence. Do you actually think that's possible?
That's possible, especially to say, hey, you know, let's take this thing out of there and let's put it out on the table and let there be some public discussion, public hearings, public comments, public participation in the process for a change.
Now, assuming that bill does go through, which seems actually like a safe bet at this point in time, you yourselves are working on other compensation bills trying to...
Yes, and probably will take some legal action as well.
People, if they go to your website, they can find out details on these compensation bills as well?
Oh, yes. We just put up the text of a couple of the versions today. We have them all up there.
And one thing that seems unique about this is that yourself and the other downwinders have had absolutely no say in any of this process so far. Is that right?
That is exactly the case. Yeah, we have had no input. We had no input in the RICO either. Well, of course, nobody had any input into their own victimization either. That was all done behind closed doors and decisions made on high.
So one of the things you all are calling for seems to be, for one thing, that the Department of Energy should not have a hand in any of this bill.
Absolutely not.
And what would you see as the best way, then, of developing a structure to come up with a solution for that?
I think the first thing that has to be done, it has to be taken out of the hands of the Department of Energy, and it has to be taken out of the hands of the White House, and it needs to be put in a format where the public has a voice in the process, where there isn't a rush to judgment and see how fast we can slam something through Congress, but where there is hearings and committee meetings in the open. And I think that's the only way, is where the public can have a say-so. And then we'll see what all the different victims actually want and don't want. At this point, I don't think we really know, because nobody's bothered to ask across the board.
Let's go back a little bit to when Secretary of Richardson became in charge of the Department of Energy, mm-hmm. and David Michaels was...
And Dr. Phil Urpain, yes.
At that point in time, it seemed amongst the downwinder community that there was a sense of hope that with someone new in charge...
I don't know about among the downwinder
community,
because we'd already had experience with them before. I think the other workers felt that way. We felt very skeptical about it.
Interesting. So what was, from your perspective, what was the history with him?
When he started working on this, he always talked about how the plight of the poor Navajo uranium miners was the guiding light in his life on this issue. And we all know out in the West that he hasn't done one damn thing for the Navajo uranium miners, including made no effort when he was in Congress to see that they got included under RECA, which he continues to use as the example of how they resolved all these problems, including those of the poor Navajo uranium miner. And, you know, we've been there, heard that, had that done unto, and we didn't find much. And we've had DOE officials for 20 years out feeling our pain, and the pain's still there. At the same time that Richardson constantly talks about how hearing about all these Navajo uranium miners dying drove him on, the government is not doing anything to push the reform of RECA so that the Native American miners are fairly represented, and the administration hasn't even provided enough money in this year's budget to fund the claims that will be filed this year under RECA. In June, RECA runs out of money for the year. So you can't have it both ways. You can't be all concerned and want to get something done for somebody over here and yet not provide funds for what you're already supposed to be doing.
So would it be fair to say then that when he was appointed as head of the DOE that in fact you were somewhat distressed by that?
I figured it was business as usual. It is the Department of Energy, after all. You know, I think how when they have had hearings about the workers, they have steadfastly refused to hear from any victims other than those the DOE wants heard from. Hanford downwinders were not allowed to participate. Off-site residents of even Oak Ridge and Paducah were not allowed to testify.
So, again, looking at the DOE coming forward and saying they injured these workers and then coming up with this very lightweight, to say the least, compensation, do you think any of this was good for your cause, or do you see the whole thing as a setback?
Oh, I think it's good for our cause if we deal with it for what it is and we don't let them get away with it. They can try to railroad this thing through in a hurry, but that doesn't mean that we can't take the bolts out of the tracks in the process and leave that train sitting there and leave them with some explaining to do. So the ultimate verdict will be whether we can take advantage of it or whether they and stop them from getting away with it. And I think we will. I think we will.
You just heard from Jay Truman, director of downwinders.org. If you'd like to find out more information about the organization and read copies of the reports and proposals mentioned in this interview, you can connect to them on the web at www.downwinders.org, or you can mail them at Downwinders, P.O. Box 111, Lava Hot Springs, Idaho, 83246. That address one more time. Downwinders, P.O. Box 111, Lava Hot Springs, Idaho, 83246.
Thanks to Mike McCormick of KCMU in Seattle for that interview.
There was a check on Charlie. He didn't crack a smile, but it's no laughing parted when you've been on the murder mile. Only takes one itchy trigger, one more widow, one less white nigger. Oliver's on his feet to stay. Oliver's on.
This is Michael Parenti for Real History, a series of talks by me about important and controversial themes in history, many of which have been buried or ignored by those who control our intellectual environment. Those who control our vision of the past exercise a preeminent control over how we see the present and the future. Today I'm going to deal with the history regarding the events leading up to World War II and the origins of World War II. The usual explanations for World War II are the following. First, Hitler was a maniac and bent on world conquest, and nothing could stop him. Second, the West tried to avoid war by appeasing him. Third, the Soviet Union entered into an unholy alliance with Hitler in the Hitler-Stalin Pact and collaborated and made it possible for him to have his successes. I want to show that all three of these statements are misleading and in some respects downright false in their implications. Let's begin with the first one. Hitler could have been stopped. He was not unstoppable, and there were powerful forces in the German army itself that were ready to stop him. In 1935, Hitler unilaterally scrapped the Versailles Peace Treaty that limited Germany to 7 divisions. He began a major mobilization of 21 divisions. He then told his generals he was going to move toward 36 divisions. His generals were stunned. 7 divisions was woefully inadequate, but this was a mobilization for another total war in Europe. In 1937, Hitler told his general staff that indeed he planned war against France, Poland, and Russia, and it would come sometimes within the next 6 years. In fact, it came within 2 years. Again, Hitler's generals were absolutely flabbergasted about this and really concerned. Another war, a total war against all of Europe, was one that would bring the inevitable defeat and destruction of Germany. Well, what happened was a concerted conspiracy was begun by the German general staff to kill Hitler and remove the Nazis from power. The Wehrmacht, the German army, would surround and move against the Nazi SS divisions. Key commanders would move their divisions in place and take over the Nazi elite forces. A special commando unit would be set up to storm Hitler's headquarters and kill him. The generals did not see how Germany could fight 2 million French, the entire Polish army, and the small but powerful Czechoslovakian army, not to mention the British, who would be joining in inevitably. To save Germany, they decided to move against Hitler, but they got no cooperation from the West. In 1936, Hitler violated the Versailles Peace Treaty by remilitarizing the Rhineland. England and France did nothing to stop him. Hitler said England and France would do nothing to stop. His generals said it was too risky to move into the Rhineland. England and France proved Hitler right. In 1938, the generals were about to strike. Much of the German general staff was involved. They hated Adolf Hitler. They hated the way the Nazis had treated the German military staff. And I counted about 60 or so senior officers who were eventually executed by the Nazis or arrested or died one way or the other, when these plans were eventually exposed. So they were ready to move again, but Hitler annexed Austria, and the Western leaders did nothing, and the plans to do in Hitler had to be postponed. They were temporarily, politically impossible because Hitler was triumphing so much. The Western allies gave him Austria on a platter. It was hard to convince people that Hitler was destroying Germany when, in fact, he seemed to be empowering Germany. Later that same year, in September 1938, war loomed inevitably. It seemed inevitable again, a war that the German generals believed they could not win. Hitler was laying claim to the entire Western industrial base of Czechoslovakia, known as the Sudetenland. It was time to act. To destroy Hitler or Germany would be destroyed, was the thinking among the German general staff. And by the way, not just with the German military, but with other elements in the Abwehr, which was the German secret intelligence, not the Nazi Gestapo, not the Nazi party, but the government group, and a number of other groups. They were people who felt that Hitler had to be stopped. They were themselves all pretty much conservatives, by the way. Let me quote from Herbert Moley Mason's book, To Kill the Devil, which is an account of the attempts against Hitler. He tells about one of the generals, Witzleben, who tells Heinz to recruit a company of commandos with which to storm the chancellery to take Hitler into custody. Witzleben suggests that Heinz's commandos should comprise students and workers as well as Wehrmacht officers, so that the world would realize that this was not a South American-style army coup, but a revolt against tyranny by a cross-section of the German people. Heinz got busy and soon had 60 men together. He and Oster, who was another conspirator, hatched a plan. They agreed that the push could only be guaranteed a success if the Führer were to be killed on the spot. In their eyes, Hitler dead was unquestionably better than Hitler alive and in prison. At H hour, Heinz would lead his commandos into the chancellery, blow in the doors, and rush upstairs and arrest the Führer. Heinz said he would see to it that an incident was provoked, providing an excuse to shoot Hitler down and then and there. Shot while trying to escape was the standard Gestapo and SS explanation for execution of political prisoners. And Heinz said the same phrase could be applied in the case of the Führer. Meanwhile, the other German generals would order the regular troops into action. By mid-September, the conspirators believed they had the pistol cocked and ready, aimed at the head of state. All that was needed was the order to pull the trigger. The trigger pulling would be initiated by Hitler himself when he announced publicly his intention to seize Czechoslovakia by force, and the hammer would fly forward when the British and French handed down their decision to go to war over the principle of safeguarding the integrity of small nations. Beck believed this is what they would do. Beck was the German general who was in charge of the conspiracy. The Czechoslovakian people believed that the British and French would do the very same thing, you know. On that same day, by the way, at that same time, Hitler ordered a panzer division with supporting infantry to parade through Berlin. The crowd stood sullenly and watched them pass. This is Mason's description, by the way. It's a very interesting point. He notes that the Führer had hoped for enthusiasm. Watching the apathetic reaction from a chancellery window, he was disgusted. He turned away and he said to an adjutant, "I can't wage a war yet with people like this." In other words, the German people were not all that gung-ho about war. They were ready to take Hitler in if it meant an end to the inflation and if it meant a relative betterment in economic conditions. In fact, the German workers were having a very tough time. One-third cut in their wages, increases in their taxes. They were having a very hard time, but it was still better than total unemployment, and it was still better than the starvation that some of them faced under the Weimar. But there was no enthusiasm for any idea of war again. They had just had a bitter and terrible war just 17 years before, and they remember the hardships and the loss and whatever else. So Hitler did not have mass support for war, much outside his party. Well, the German generals were ready to move against Hitler if he struck against Czechoslovakia and led to an impossible war. But once again, British Prime Minister Chamberlain came to Hitler's rescue. The Czechs were ready to fight. The Soviet Union was ready to fight and said it would join Czechoslovakia in the war against Hitler. The Soviet Union made repeated overtures to Great Britain and France and Poland and Czechoslovakia for a joint military pact, security pact, against Hitler, that if he attacked any one of them, he would be attacked by all of them. But the British and French refused to join such a pact. Instead, the British and French hurried to Munich and gave Hitler the Sudetenland. The German general plan was collapsed. There was going to be no threat of war. There was going to be no danger to Germany. There was going to be no reason to move against Hitler. The conspirators pulled back. When the German military moved into western Czechoslovakia, and they took all the western half of Czechoslovakia, they were impressed by the great defenses. Czechoslovakia could not stand alone against Germany, and so it surrendered. Czechoslovakia was not even allowed to attend Munich. 5 months after the Munich conference, it was at the Munich conference that Chamberlain gave Hitler Czechoslovakia, and that was the beginning of the end of the peace. 5 months later, Hitler moved in and took all of Czechoslovakia. By the way, even after Munich, the Soviet Union offered to stand with Czechoslovakia, even offering to send troops and planes. The Soviets, however, were denied passage to Czechoslovakia by Poland. Poland was a right-wing military dictatorship, and Poland thereby did its small part in the digging of its own grave. Let's take the second explanation, that Great Britain and France appeased Hitler, and this is what led to the war. They proved weak and had no backbone. Well, they were war-weary, and they were unwilling to fight. They were willing to take peace at any price. That's really not quite true. They had been war-weary after World War I, and yet they proved themselves very willing to fight. Right after World War I, British and French sent, and 12 other nations sent expeditionary forces to invade and fight in the Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia, as it was still called then, to overthrow the Russian Revolution. So they were quite ready to fight if it was to fight communists. They were not ready to fight the fascists. They were reluctant to confront Germany even when it was weak and could have been stopped in 1935 when it had only about 7 or 10 divisions. They had wind that the German generals were wavering. They had wind that there was a very serious conspiracy afoot. The British intelligence heard from the Abwehr, the German secret service, secret intelligence. The Abwehr tried to feed London secret information on the Nazi buildup. Chamberlain was not interested. Chamberlain failed to respond to all overtures from the anti-Nazi Germans, even high-placed ones who commanded divisions of troops, even conservative ones. In other words, I believe Chamberlain was not an appeaser. He was an active collaborator of Adolf Hitler's. They actively encouraged Hitler's policy. On Czechoslovakia, Chamberlain himself threatened Czechoslovakia if the Czechs failed to accept Munich. He threatened to freeze their assets. He would deny them all materials if they decided to stand up alone against Germany. And he handed over all Czech assets in England to Adolf Hitler when Hitler took over all of Czechoslovakia. He engaged in the active participation and dismemberment of Czechoslovakia and handed it over to the Nazis on a platter. Chamberlain saw Hitler and Nazism as a bulwark against communism in Germany, and he saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against communism in Europe. With a few exceptions, like Winston Churchill, Western leaders were more concerned with the Bolshevik specter than with the fascist reality. They were uneasy about Hitler's emergent power, but they didn't look upon fascism with the same loathing and fear that they did communism. Unlike the communists, the fascists were not a threat to private enterprise. If anything, the fascists had crushed socialist organizations in Germany and Italy and had made these countries safer for private capital. Now, to be sure, Chamberlain and his associates were eager to avoid war. They didn't want war. But much of that eagerness arose not from some kind of pacifism, some commitment to peace, or peace at any price, but from a willingness to strike the kind of bargain with a Nazi leader that they would never dream of entering into with the Soviets. The British historian Jeffrey Barraclough argued, quote, "Hitler's successes in foreign policy would do less to German rearmament, the deficiencies and limitations of which were known to competent military circles, than to the tacit alliance of powerful reactionary elements in England and France, which, although loath to see a reassertion of German equality, was still more unwilling to check it by military alliance with Soviet Russia, or to run the risk of social revolution in Germany as a result of Hitler's fall." In other words, I'm not saying that Chamberlain necessarily loved Hitler, although there were plenty of leaders in the West who did. There was all sorts of people in America. Henry Ford was an open Nazi admirer, and a number of other American plutocrats, and a number of people in England also. But Chamberlain's feeling was, if I had to choose between Nazism and Hitler, or the risk, even the risk of Soviet influence in Germany, then we will take Nazism. They could much better live with the reality, the horrible reality of fascism, than with the future imagined risk of socialism. Western leaders had never really quite reconciled themselves to the existence of a socialist Russia, and they, at the same time, they did fear Germany's growing strength. So their strategy was to turn Hitler's aggression against the USSR. So it wasn't appeasement. Chamberlain went to Munich because he had a plan. And that plan was to give Hitler what he wanted and then send Hitler east to attack Bolshevik Russia. After all, Chamberlain and his party had just attacked Bolshevik Russia. Let's see, we're talking 1939. They had just been there just 18 years before, 1921, invading Russia and trying to stop the revolution. By the way, this was not an altogether unrealistic plan. Given the rabid anti-communism and anti-Sovietism professed by the Nazi leaders, they were quite ready, and they talked about moving east, you know. The commander-in-chief of the French armed forces, General Gamelin, wrote in his memoirs that one of the aims of the Anglo-French alliance was to bring about a clash between German and Soviet interests. Harry Truman had made that famous statement. We ought to let Hitler and Stalin fight each other until they totally exhaust each other and bleed each other white. Now, in Asia, the United States and Great Britain has had something of the same plan. They did very little to deter Japanese aggressions in Manchuria and China. And here, too, the anticipation was that the Japanese might move against the Soviet Union. And so they were willing to give them a free hand, just as they were willing to give Hitler a free hand in Central Europe, in Austria and Czechoslovakia. And by the way, this is exactly what happened. In 1938, the Japanese militarists entered an alliance with Germany and Italy. It was called the Anti-Comintern Pact. The Comintern was the Communist International, made up of International Association of Communist Parties, which were heavily under the influence and hegemony of the Soviet Communist Party. The Anti-Comintern Pact, an alliance of three fascist nations, Japan, Germany, and Italy, and they vowed a joint struggle against world communism. The Japanese then attacked the Soviet Union that same year near the Outer Mongolia area, leading to a full-scale war that ended with Japan's suffering 18,000 casualties and military defeat. During all this time, by the way, American corporations continued to expand their investments in German heavy industry, including arms productions. I'm talking about corporations like Ford Motor Company and General Motors. Now let's move to the third proposition, that the Hitler-Stalin Pact, or the Nazi-Soviet Pact, the most talked about treaty in history. By the way, it's still regularly referred to in the U.S. media at every opportunity as a meeting of the devils about how Hitler and Stalin met and made this alliance. Munich, by the way, is never described as the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact or the Nazi-British Pact, which it was. It's always antiseptically called Munich. Well, as I said, the Soviet Union had made repeated overtures to conclude collective security pacts with the United States and Great Britain in order to contain both German and Japanese aggression. These overtures were repeatedly ignored or rebuffed, including the Soviet attempts to render armed assistance to Czechoslovakia. In time, Soviet leaders lost what little confidence they had had in the sincerity and ultimate purposes of the Western democracies. It was evident that had Hitler at this time struck directly at Russia, he would have encountered very little, if any, opposition from France or Britain. As the historian Foster Ray Dulles notes, the American government and Great Britain and France had an attitude which was to do nothing to free the Soviet Union from its anxieties regarding Hitler's crusade against communism. If it were impossible to crush Nazi aggression by a united front, Stalin felt the next best thing for Russia was to attempt to divert any immediate German attack from the Soviet Union. In the summer of 1939, the Soviets made frantic efforts to enter into negotiations with Western leaders, French and British leaders. The French and British sent a delegation by boat to Moscow, which took a week. When they arrived, they had no protocol papers. And the question came up is, where are your papers? Who do you represent? Can you negotiate with state authority? It became clear during that summer that a stall was underway. So what in fact happened is that Stalin began to make overtures with the Nazis. Isolated by the West, frustrated in its last-minute attempts to form an anti-Nazi alliance with Great Britain and France, and I would point out the Soviet Union was the only country in 1936, 1937, and 1938 that was the only major country that was trying to form a an anti-Nazi alliance. And believing that it was being set up as a target for Hitler's aggression, and they believed correctly, the Soviets decided to sign an 11th-hour non-aggression treaty with Hitler in the summer of 1939. To this day, the conservatives talk about this diabolic affinity between the Nazis and the communists for signing this pact. Conservative news columnist George Will would write, "The 1939 Nazi-Soviet pact truly was a joining of kindred spirits." On another occasion, George Will described the Soviet Union as a regime that was, quote, once allied with Hitler. In fact, the Soviet Union was never allied with Nazi Germany. The pact was a treaty, but it wasn't an alliance. It no more indicated an alliance with Nazism than would a non-aggression treaty between the United States and the Soviets indicate a U.S. alliance with communism. The pact was neither an alliance nor an agreement for the partition of Poland. Now, Munich had been a true alliance for partition. The British and the French dictated partition to the Czechs. They said, you obey, this is what's going to happen, and you better toe the line, and the Germans are taking you over. The Soviet government undertook no such action against the Poles. They merely promised to remain neutral, which is what the Poles had always asked them to do anyway. The Poles did not want to enter an alliance with the Soviets against the Germans. More than this, the agreement was, in the last resort, anti-German because it limited the German advance eastward in case of war. And this is what Winston Churchill emphasized. With the pact, the Soviets hoped to ward off what they most dreaded, a united capitalist attack on Soviet Russia. And really, it was difficult to see what other course Soviet Russia could have followed. Ideally, they wanted the Grand Alliance with the West against the Nazis. But barring that, they turned the tables and made a pact with Hitler. When Hitler attacked Poland, the Soviets moved into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, the Baltic territories that had been taken from them by Germany, Britain, and Poland in 1919. They overthrew the right-wing dictatorships that were in those countries. By the way, today we ought to remember when we hear about Lithuania going back to its democracy, that Lithuania wasn't a democracy. They were right-wing dictatorships that the Western counter-revolutionaries had installed in the Baltic states. The three states were incorporated as three republics into the USSR. The Soviets also took back Western Belarus, the Western Ukraine, and other areas seized from them and incorporated into the Polish right-wing dictatorship in 1921 under the Treaty of Riga. This has been portrayed as proof that they colluded with the Nazis to gobble up Poland, but the Soviets reoccupied only the area that had been taken from them 20 years before. History offers few, if any, examples of a nation refusing the opportunity to regain territory that had been seized from it. In any case, by reclaiming their old boundaries, the Soviets did draw a line on the Nazi advance. Even after Hitler attacked Poland and Great Britain and France declared war on Germany, the Western collaboration did not end. And this is a part of the history that's not known, never mentioned by George Will, never mentioned by commentators today, and not mentioned by many historians either. When Hitler struck east into Poland, nothing happened on the Western Front. Now, don't forget, Great Britain and France had just declared war. There were still feelers from London and Paris about making a separate peace with Hitler so that he could concentrate on Soviet Russia. From September 1939, when World War II began, to May of 1940, about 8 months, there was no fighting between Germany and the Western Allies, even though they were at war with each other. The French began to call it La Guerre Drôle, the funny war, or the droll war, or the lazy war, whatever you want to call it. Others called it the Sitzkrieg, instead of the Blitzkrieg, it was a Sitzkrieg, a sit-down war. In England and France, it was called the phony war. There was very little fighting. Now, Hitler had every intention of taking on the USSR. That was going to be his final big fight. He wanted the breadbasket of the Ukraine. He wanted the oil fields of Baku. He wanted to destroy the communists. But he had to widen his base before attacking the Soviet Union. And so he took Denmark and Norway. He invaded them in April of 1940. That gave him more resources, more food, more farmlands, more factories, more conscript labor. Even then, high-placed conspirators in the German General Staff made overtures to Great Britain for coordination of efforts. General Oster, Colonel Sass, General Beck, and even Field Marshal Rommel later on, they warned the British of Hitler's forthcoming, quote, violent, brutal offensive in the West. The British didn't take it serious. The British understood that there was an understanding with the Germans, and they were giving them all this European real estate, and they were finally going to move east and knock off the communist menace. If the British would only guarantee the plotters, the Germans said, a fair peace, they would go at Hitler and overthrow his Nazi regime. The new government would relinquish Czechoslovakia and Poland and everything else except Austria. That was their first offer. London did not even take the offer seriously. In May of 1940, Hitler struck west. He wiped out France and much of the British army at Dunkirk. Then he attacked the Soviet Union in 1941. Stalin had expected it sooner or later. In 1939, Stalin had said, we have 10 years. In 10 years, we have to do what Britain did in 100 years. And there came the forced industrialization, as Soviet Russia built a whole new industrial base east of the Urals, an industrial base which eventually outproduced Hitler in tanks, planes, and artillery. 80% of the German casualties were on the Eastern Front. The scale and ferocity of the fighting was unparalleled in the West, or in any modern warfare ever. There was nothing in the Western Front that could compare to the Battle of Stalingrad, involving millions of troops, the Battle of Leningrad, where 2.5 million Soviets died, the Battle of Kursk, involving tens of thousands of tanks, the Battle of Warsaw, which took 2 months, the Battle of Berlin, where 3 million Soviet troops were arrayed against 1.5 million German troops, with almost 1 million casualties by both sides. Most discussions in the West about World War II focus on the Western War, which is about one-fifth of the actual war, and ignore the scale and horror and heroism of the Eastern Front. Most discussions in the West about the eve of World War II give us the usual blather about the Hitler-Stalin Pact and say little about the active collaboration of the right-wing Tory government, about the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact. Just as little today is said about the active collaboration of a right-wing U.S. government with fascists throughout the Third World and with Nazis in the Republican Party and in Bush's own campaign. The fascists are okay because they defend private property and corporate investments. It's the communists that are the menace, according to those who own the world. Those of us who want democracy might want to think about this a little more seriously. This is Michael Parenti for Some Real History.
I don't know good horse as we trot in this dark here, robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing, lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest.
The music used in today's program was Johnny Jingle by Todd Rundgren and Oliver's Army by Elvis Costello.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.